Hello, this is Scott Wells for The Magic Word, and today I have as my very special guest, Eric DeCamps. Hello there, Eric.
Hey, Scott. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing just great. Good to talk with you here today. And I wanted to visit a little bit about Pure Magic, the one-man show that you have developed over the years and going to be presenting in Chicago over October 19th and 20th and 21st. Mm-hmm. So now this is a one-man show, and there are not a lot of guys who are out there actually doing what you're doing. Specifically, I can only think of a handful. You know, Ricky Jay and Paul Gertner. I think you probably got a few other people you can mention.
Yeah, guys. Of course, John Carney has a theater show, and so does a guy by the name of Steve Cohen.
Yeah, that little thing called Chamber Magic, I think.
Yeah, just a little thing. Yeah, he was just in Atlanta, I think, over the weekend, last weekend.
In fact, I was just talking with Dan Garrett, and his wife Carol had gone to the show. Dan was a house guest here. He had been coming through for a lecture. So in developing these shows, I know that it's not an easy thing. I mean, I've seen you do bits and pieces of this, like at the 4F convention or other conventions where you've, you know, done your egg bag routine, or perhaps in a close-up show, done the Dean's Box, you know, with the Davenport Brothers type of presentation. And it's kind of like, you know, years ago I remember seeing John Cornelius perform at the TAOM, and he would do bits and pieces in close-up shows. And then he finally, when he put it all together in his FISM Award, winning act, you know, it had finally come together. I can see that same creative process in what you're doing. In other words, you don't seem to be finished with a routine and feel comfortable to put into an act until you know that it's fully refined.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's a whole process. And, you know, I've actually had two one-man shows here. The first one was debuted in 2007 in Rockefeller Center at the Lincoln Room at the Three West Club. Mm-hmm. And that show was directed by Steve Chiffo, who was very funny because Steve is a very, very talented actor and a very talented magician. I was his first magic teacher, so it was positions were just opposed. He was directing me for my show because I hadn't done a public show in probably, close to 15 years at that point.
Yeah.
Publicly, I've done, you know, corporate parties and all that other stuff, yes, but I had never done a public show in a long time, ever since Mostly Magic closed in 1993. And so we got together. I knew I needed a good eye, an experienced eye, both theatrically, which is very important, and magically. I felt, in my opinion, Scott, I really did feel that if I would just go to a theatrical director, he wouldn't understand the concerns that I have as a magician and the limitations that I have as a magician. So I wanted someone who had experience in both worlds. So Steve was an obvious choice for me. We worked together, and the first show was called An Evening of Intimate Magic with Eric DeCamps, and it was a 90-minute show, no intermission, and it was a true parlor show. The Lincoln Room is exactly that. It was a parlor room with a fireplace, and I worked in front of the fireplace. I had a magic table out, and a performance table, I should say, and we had around 50, 54 people per show in seating capacity.
Yeah.
And it was a great show. It was a lot of fun, a lot of work. We rehearsed all the time, every week, three times a week, and it was a lot of thought process going into it. And
there's a lot of competition, certainly, for theatrical shows in New York City, of all places.
Yeah.
And so I would think it'd be difficult to draw a crowd and to market it properly to get people to come in to see what some people might think. Oh, it's just a magic show, and we just had a magician at our son's birthday party or something.
It's always the uphill battle that magic has anyway, that they think it's sometimes just for children entertainment. But when you see someone like Ricky Jay or Paul Gertner or Steve Cohen, and you go and witness what they're doing, you develop a lady who's never been exposed to this. I mean, we have, but.
Right, of course.
Exposed that to the fact that magic is a beautiful.
Well, how did you overcome that as far as marketing it and getting butts in the seats?
Well, I was fortunate because it was a small show, so I didn't need to have 1,000 people per show. I mean, that's a big problem. That's a big problem with Broadway, you know, and getting butts in the seats, as you said. So I marketed to what I knew would be a good core group for me, which would be the Magic community. Mm-hmm. So, and they would tell their friends and bring in people, and that's basically what happened. And that's how we got the shows to sell out, and we did that. I mean, you can't do that forever, because it's just a limited thing. You need to have fresh people to come in. And plus, honestly, I want to do a show that I want. I'd rather do a show for lay people than magicians. Nothing against them, my fellow magicians, but I want the general public to look at magic and realize that it is a beautiful art form.
Right.
It's an art that I'm in love with, and I want them to see that, you know, the love that I have for the art form, and project that onto them and give it a newfound respect in their minds and in their
design. And you like that intimate setting, certainly, I guess, much better than you would with a larger show. If it's something where there's 1,000 people, it's harder to reach out. I mean, breaking the fourth wall is one thing, but then trying to engage each and every person, it's a more difficult thing to do, obviously, with 1,000-plus people. But I would think with a more intimate setting with 20, 50, or 75 people, it would be a little bit – it's still challenging, but a little easier.
Well, it's different, and that's the beauty of what we do. Here's the case in point. I mean, people go see an illusionist, and nothing wrong. There's a lot of great illusionists out
sure.
there. And personally, I love watching a good illusionist from work. But I think what the beauty of what I do and what I know that you do also is that when people say, but, you know, he didn't have any boxes. He was, well, Mike, you have a box. But but you know, everything is right in front of your eyes. And everything is very organic, so to speak. There is nothing contrived in anything. That's very important to me when I look at magic and when I put together magic pieces to work on. It has to look and it has to be an extension of who I am. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to sell it. If you don't believe in the product, you're not going to be able to sell the product.
What's the most difficult part of putting together something like this or working that room or developing the show or marketing? Or, you know, what do you find the most challenging for you and what is the easiest for you?
Well, to me, I don't like the idea of the whole marketing campaign. I mean, it's fun to a certain extent, but that's actually not the fun part for me. The fun part for me is actually working and doing the show. That's the part. I mean, if you don't like rehearsals and if you don't like practicing, you got to find another endeavor.
Mm-hmm. True. Right.
Well, it doesn't just have to be magic. It can be any, you know, sculptor, see if you're a sculptor or whatever, but you have to put the time in. And it's a lot of alone time, too, because you're developing techniques. Magic just has this weird thing that we develop all this technique and then we hide it so that it doesn't get seen. Everything looks effortless.
Right. So it's actually, of course, ours is the art of concealment. And if you're doing it wrong, then people can see what you're doing. If you do it right, then they have no idea what you're doing. So it's kind of a catch-22.
It's like Roger Klaus used to tell me all the time when I would, if I were to amaze him with something, with a piece or a particular sleight of hand technique, he would say, never mind the tech, I didn't even suspect. And
yeah.
that's beautiful about what we do when you get at a certain level. It's not easy. Because a lot of us want to show off our skill, but you really want to show a minimum amount of skill so that everything looks amazing. You should be able to handle the props well. I don't want to get into the juggling thing because that's just not me. I mean, I enjoy the practice. I enjoyed the collaboration with a person like Steve Chiffo or later on a gentleman like Bob Fitch.
And so you had done the show early on in early 2000, and then when was it? You said 2007 that you had done another show?
The original show, and it was the one in Rockefeller Center at the Lincoln Room, was in 2007. I did an 8-week run there directed by Steve Chiffo. Then when in my final show there, it was very, very good because we had a gentleman in the audience who came to scout, and he was scouting me for corporate events. And at the end of the show, called me and came to speak to me and said, Eric, I came to see you for corporate events that I hold at my nightclub, but honestly, I have a better idea. And I said, okay, what's that? And we talked about it, and his idea was to have a magic show at one of his nightclubs. His name is Chris Mazzilli, and he owns Gotham Comedy Club and the Metropolitan Room in New York City. The club is one of the top-rated comedy clubs in the country. It's a beautiful 300-seat room. But That said, we met at the club, and it was really weird because he did a very smart move. He says, meet me at the Metropolitan Room, such and such, and whatever. So we make a date, and we'll meet him there. And I got there early, and I walk into the room. And I have to tell you, Scott, I walk into this room. It was like walking through a time portal.
Wow.
I feel like I'm in 1940s New York. It's just got these booths, these tables, a little stage, beautiful lighting. And I just like, wow. And I could see in my mind's eye, I felt like I could see Vernon performing in the back with his tuxedo and his slick back hair, young Vernon doing his magic. It was just really, really cool.
You could almost hear the big band sounds over there, Tommy Dorsey and everybody, huh?
Exactly. Just felt really, really, really cool. So we met. Struck a deal. We did an 8-week run in the first run, and it went very well. And I then extended it to 2 more runs, and I had 3 very successful runs there, and it was a lot of fun. I was lucky that very, very fortunate to have Bob Fitch. I mean, he's the man. So it was a great experience for me to work with Bob. I mean, Bob and I have been friends for 25, 30 years, and we've always talked about working together, but I never had. We came close in 2001, but things just didn't work out for me with my schedule at that time because I had thought about this. I mean, putting together a one-man show was always a dream for me, going way back to when I got into magic in the early, when I was working the nightclubs in New York. When I met Fitch at the nightclub, he fell in love with the space. He thought the space was very, very good. It's very difficult to explain to people who don't perform that you have to have this feeling in a room. You got to make that room your own. You have to own that room. It has to become your home. And that these people that you don't know that come in and buy tickets have no idea who you are. At the end of the performance, they feel like they know you and they were home and they feel glad that they were invited to come and see this and have this hopefully wonderful experience.
You know, I can kind of understand that from a comedian standpoint who might be a little more improvisational, if you will, whereas what you're doing with a completely scripted thing, you don't have the latitude to kind of go outside of certain bounds to try to bring people in. In other words, I often see a comedian who will talk to somebody in the front row and say, where are you from, or what do you do? And then he'll kind of riff on that and try to get the audience on his side. So I would think that would be a little bit more difficult challenge for a magician, again, with a scripted show where you know that you're going to have one routine follow another. Certainly the comedians know where they're going with their humor, but they're trying to get the feel of the audience first and to get them to like them and to love them so that way that anything they do will be gold. So I see that really as a challenge, but I know that you have overcome that.
It is a challenge, and it's an interesting thing because you have to be. You've heard of the term being in the moment, right?
Right.
What does that mean? It wasn't until my final show at the Metropolitan Room that I realized exactly because I felt it. Show is scripted. I have things that I have to say because I. For them to appreciate what I'm doing, they have to understand that you have to follow. You have to be able to engage that audience. So what does it mean to be in the moment? Well, it's a very difficult thing to explain to someone who's never been in that moment. And again, I've always heard the term. I didn't understand it until this one performance where I was in this room. We had about 110 people. I was surrounded, and I'm performing this. And during the show, all of a sudden, I have an overwhelming feeling of the audience. 110 people and me were one consciousness. I knew exactly what they were thinking, and they knew exactly where I was, and then they were going to follow me. And it was such an incredible experience. And the amount of energy that you burn when you do something like that, I can't explain it again to people because, you know, I'm not digging ditches. You know, I'm not climbing up the side of a building and something like that. But it's an internal energy that you're burning, and you know, I watched the show, and I would take off my suit jacket, and it was drenched.
Yeah,
just that energy that you're burning to keep them engaged, and keep them interested in what you're doing, and so that they follow it. Because listen, drunk people are very difficult to entertain with magic, and I get through this. I was doing an intimate evening in Rock Center. You know, I had people that went out to dinner, had a couple of drinks, not just a couple, I mean a lot of drinks, and came and sat in the front row, and they were got to an argument. It was a very, very sticky situation, but I was fortunate through my experience to be able to handle it, and it worked out at the end. And so the people who are inebriated, it's very difficult because they have no attention span. They don't know. So when you're walking through magic, that you need that attention. They need to focus on what you're doing because right. they don't understand the impossibilities of what you're doing. For example, there are many art forms, right? You have music. Music is beautiful because it's sexist. You don't have to think about music. You sit down. It's very passive. The music enters your ears. It affects you on an emotional level.
Right.
Okay? But magic requires attention from the spectator. And that's why, and it also, for you to be able to misdirect them and read them and lead them down the garden path, so to speak, you have to have their attention. You have to guide their attention. It's not so much misdirection as it is redirection so that you can emphasize what you want to emphasize and de-emphasize what you definitely want them to understand or see.
Right.
There's ways, there's many techniques in doing that, and certainly speaking is one of them, and a very strong one. So you have to be able to engage them, let them understand the process so that they can understand. Once you set that and they understand this is a solid wall. This is a car. I'm going to push this car through this solid wall. Once they understand that, then they go, oh, my gosh, you know.
Right.
So take a silver dollar. It's a real silver dollar, which it is. I use real stuff. Place it in your hand, and it vanishes. And it's very
that's what separates reality from illusion. Whenever that they can understand that you're defying physical reality.
That's what we do. I mean, all theater has to have conflict. If you don't have conflict in a storyline, it doesn't matter. Every movie has the same, only so many basis storylines that you can do, but they all have to have conflict. Our conflict is natural. It's built in. It's defying the laws of nature and making what seems impossible. So that's what we do, and that's what we want to sell. And that sense of, lack of a better term, wonder that you give them, that childlike feeling is what you really want to give them.
Well, you know, in Henning Nell's book on Magic and Showmanship, he talks about these different levels of where you're getting people's emotions to rise and fall, and there are smaller moments within the overarching routine, or act, I should say, with each routine having its surprises and everything. So I'm assuming it's kind of like that. When you had decided to place one particular routine in a particular place within an act, was that something that you had to kind of sort out and work with the audience? And before a live audience, you said, okay, well, this would work better if I put this routine someplace else and for this to build properly. Did you fool around with that a little bit, those ideas?
Without a doubt, you have to do that. I mean, I have a pretty large body of performance material. Actually, right now I have two distinct 75-minute shows. I finally put the other one together last year. It's very good. I've had a lot of fun with it, but I like the Magic Show. And the Pure Magic Show, when I laid it out and put together the program, one of the routines that I've done for many, many years, and it's the coin routine that I love to perform for lay people, is the my version of the Ramsey Coins and Cylinder.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 80s when I was working on it and performing it at Mostly Magic, a lot of the guys said, "Well, Eric, that's a magician's trick. Why are you wasting your time?" The lay people, I says, "No. Properly presented, it will be a very entertaining and engaging thing." So I worked through it and finally got it to work. And then, you know, I would go on open mic night at the club, and, you know, first week would kind of weak. Next week, went back the next week. It was a little bit better, and week after week, until finally good enough to put into the weekend shows. But in this particular case, I specifically stayed away from the cylinder and coins because I had developed this other coin routine, which I wanted to open with. And it's very, very clean. And the truth of the matter is when people think, when the general public thinks of a magician, the thing that comes to mind is, now you see it, now you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, my first contest act, the act that I developed for contests, and then I did it Mostly Magic also, that was the theme. Now you see it, now you don't. I wanted to give the audience that experience right up front so that they experience it, and if you do it well, they'll let down their guard. And what do I mean by that? For example, I would produce three silver dollars in the show, in this particular show, Pure Magic. Then I very cleanly, and I mean really cleanly, they vanish and reappear. They vanish completely. My hands are constantly shown empty, and then I make them reappear with my sleeve rolled up. And it looks really, really good, and I'm giving them, in my estimation, exactly what they want to see. They want to see, now you see, because that's the definition that they see, that they think, now you don't. So I give them that, but it has to be super clean and very, very strong and engaging. Because once you get that, you know, they're going to look at you and say, okay, the coins are gone. All right, I don't see. Oh, he's going to do it again. Okay, let me watch closer. No, I can't get it. I don't understand this. How does he do it? You know what? I don't care how he's doing it because I don't like challenging an audience because now
it becomes puzzles.
It becomes puzzles, and now they become on the defensive.
Right.
And you want to alleviate that. So if you do something really, really well and it's very, very clean, they're going to say, well, you know what? I can't see it, but I don't care. He's a clever guy. I'm not going to figure it out. Let me enjoy the evening.
Well, you're kind of giving a secret as to how to own the room, like you were talking about earlier, because if you set up that adversarial type of situation where that it becomes a puzzle and they're then challenging you, thinking, you know, I'm going to catch him this next time, it's kind of then becoming you versus them, as opposed to them sitting back and saying, wow, I have no idea what he's doing, but I'm having a great time. I'm just going to go along with it.
And make me feel like a kid. And that's you want to do. I mean, Robert Houdin wrote this in his memoirs many years ago, that he said there's two types of people that come to a magic show. There's the guy that comes to the magic show who wants to be fooled. I don't like using that term because it always has a connotation of someone being a fool, but wants to be pleased, okay, and enjoy the illusions, okay? And the more you do that, the more they feel like they get their money's worth. The other guy to a magic show is a guy that wants to sit down and analyze, and it takes it on a personal, it takes it to challenge his intellect. Like, I'm going to be smarter than the magician. No matter what you do, he'll never enjoy the show, because he can't enjoy the show because he puts himself in an adversarial position. My goal is to, in the beginning of the show, is to do something really good and then let them say, you know what, the guy's too good. You enjoy the show, and hopefully that works, and then you have a great time. But every little step is a major it takes time to do that, and it takes experience.
And that is something that can only be done really in front of a live audience, and that's a difficult thing for most magicians to find some place where they can be bad, if you will, you know, where they can practice something over and over and say, okay, this works, this doesn't. You know, maybe I should stand here, or I should hold something this way, or I should say this line, not that line, or I should insert something here and take this out there. But that only comes with experience. You know, timing and misdirection are two things you can't perform in front of a mirror. It has to be before a live audience.
Right. You have to understand that psychology. And, you know, like I said, this coin routine that I developed for the opening of the Pure Magic Show, something I never did in front of a live audience. I had to develop it so that it would be engaging. And, you know, thanks to both Chiffo and Bob, we developed it and made it much better. One of the things that Chiffo did, which is, I think, fantastic, and this is one of the things I think most close-up magicians, I throw myself in it too because it's the truth. Most cases, when we perform magic, and if you're going to perform it in a parlor situation, you're working behind a table. Now, if you're working behind a banquet table, it could be a 4-foot banquet table, a 6-foot banquet table, and God forbid, an 8-foot banquet table. Because it takes you forever to get around that table, to get to the audience, have a card picked, selected, or whatever. Chiffo said, Eric, why are you standing behind the table? I said, because I'm so used to always being behind a table. He goes, stand in front of the table. Walk around and do the magic in front of them so that you're right in their faces. And I said, okay. And I also secured the table, and I was in front of the table. Huge difference. Huge difference, because all the vanishes of the silver dollar is happening right in their faces, because I'm going right in front of them, taking that silver dollar and making it disappear and immediately showing my hands empty and showing them. So they're like looking at you, and you don't have that, for lack of a better term, a moat. That table acts as a bigger divider. You know what I mean?
I do know exactly what you're saying, and it also does put you closer to the audience and makes it happen, as you say, right before their eyes and under their nose. And that's one of the big advantages, certainly, of having a third party, particularly a professional director, someone who also understands magic, that can see that those little things can make a huge difference.
You're much more engaging in that situation. Of course, there are going to be parts where I have to be behind the table, and I understand that. But, you know, it's like a roller coaster ride. You have, you know, ebbs and flows. You know, you go up and down. You want to do that and keep them into, and that's how you maintain them, keeping them engaged. So it's an interesting process. But I got to tell you, at the end of the show, when you finish a show and you really do your job and the people applaud, it's amazing. It's an amazing
and satisfying, very satisfying, I'm sure.
No, without a doubt, it's an amazing feeling. You feel so, you get instant recognition for your work.
Now you have, and going back to Pure Magic, so you had presented that a couple times then for those 18 weeks, and then you later took it to the sea, I think, with the PCAM convention and out to the Magic Castle.
Yes, I did it. I did it at the PCAM convention. I did it at the castle. It was funny because I was working the PCAM convention. It was on a ship. It was a cruise line. And what, so it left Vancouver, went out for 4 or 5 days, and then it disembarked in L.A. And I said, well, wait a second, L.A.? I'll tell me. I had a whole show with, I wonder. So I made a couple of calls to the castle. Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, the booker at the time was Max, who's a buddy of mine, calls, and I get in touch with Max eventually, and he said, Eric, what is it you want to do? And I told him exactly. I said, listen, I have everything with me, so it's not going to cost anything. I'm already there. It'd be great if I could do one show, because I've never worked a castle, and it'd be really great. It'd be a special thing. He goes, let me get back to you. Give me the dates. He calls me back. I said, Eric, yeah, we have the date available, but we're not going to put you in the regular room. However, we have a theater downstairs, a space called the Pella Theater, and we can put you in there. And we do decorations there and stuff like that. And I said, that's perfect. I said, I haven't even seen the room, but that's perfect. When I got there, it was amazing. It was a good room for me. But funny thing was, we booked the thing. I get in touch with the manager and everything. We set it up. I get a phone call, and they said, Eric, tickets are going well. Would you mind doing an earlier show? I said, okay. So it's a 9 o'clock show. You can do a 7 o'clock show. I said, no problem. Fine. I'm there. It's not a problem. Okay, fine. About a week later, I get another call. Once they start advertising it, saying, listen, we don't want to kill you. show. I says, no, I'm there. I'm more than happy to. So I did 3 75 shows in one day, and it was great experience. You know, again, like you said, you have to get used to the room. So the first show was good, but it was, you know, getting used to the space. The second show was better than the first, and the third show was like blowing the roof off the castle, so to speak. It was so much fun. So much fun.
Wow. So after you finished the Magic Castle run, that was very successful. Then it was kind of on hiatus for a while, and you hadn't performed. Or I guess that's when you came to the TAOM, I believe.
TAOM in 2010, which was a great experience. I mean, Brett Henderson contacted me. He's a buddy of mine. Hull Youngblood was the president, and he was organizing the whole convention. And yeah, I guess he knew Brad and I were good friends, and they tried something new that year. Instead of having the evening shows to be stage shows, what they had wanted to do was to have parlor shows or one-man shows. So who they wound up booking as the anchor of the convention were Matt Damon was thinking in person, his one-man show, which is Marvel's show. Pop Hayden. And they built a little theater in the ballroom. Actually, they divided the ballroom into two, and they built a theater in one section. And then they built another theater for me. Mm-hmm. 175 seats, excuse me. And it was all tiered seating, and they had to truss lighting, intelligent lighting. It was just so cool. It was funny because Hulk, the first thing he says when he walked me in, it was sort of like the movie Jurassic Park. Hulk said, welcome to the Eric DeCamps.
And you were like, whoa, this is awesome. And it was a beautiful theater.
Really? Well done. So very, very well. I had a crazy man as an MC, so to speak. Hull introduced him. Bill Malone showed up, and he was kind enough to be my master of ceremonies, if you will, and introduce me, and it was a lot of fun.
That was fun. And I saw the show, too. That was just totally awesome and a beautiful thing. It seemed that time kind of almost stood still, you know, before we started recording here, we were talking about perceived time and that kind of thing. That talk about that, because that the show, again, it seemed like it only lasted a few minutes, but it was much longer than that.
Well, the When I did the original show, Intimate Magic in Rock Center, the biggest compliment that I got during that 8-week run was that I couldn't believe that it was a 90-minute show until they looked at their watch at the end of the night. See people looking at their wristwatch going like, what? And the biggest compliment was, Eric, we could not believe. We felt like you were on for 10, 15 minutes. And when we looked down, we saw that we were at the one-hour mark. And we were like in shock. And see, that's the thing about time. Time in mathematics are consistent. They are what they are. You've heard of the term a watched pot never boils.
Right.
Well, if you use a consistent temperature and everything else, it takes the same amount of time. However, we as human beings have what is called perceived time. And if you're engaged in something else, that time disappears in your mind or your perception. Pot is boiling. I mean, how many times have people gone to their offices and go to work and then all of a sudden realize, oh my God, it's noon, it's lunchtime. Where did the morning go? Because they were very engaged in what they were doing. So that's the biggest compliment to me, because when they felt like they were only 10, 15 minutes, when it was over an hour at that point, an hour and 15 minutes, let's say, because that was a 90-minute show, they were like in shock. And that was a great thing, because that means I engaged them. And I had them forget about their troubles for a while, and also made them lose track of time.
Right, and that's a beautiful thing, and that's part of, I think, the mystery as well of making time disappear in a pleasant way, too. Well, so from there, we're now going to Chicago, and you had met up with Gabe Fiore. You had been to Chicago a few times and scouted out some places.
See, Chicago to me, and I, as a young magician and studying and reading books, I would always find, you know, you hear about these great stories about, you know, the rich history of close-up magic in Chicago, these great magicians that were there. And I've always wanted to go. So finally, I'd made about four trips to look and scout some spaces, and I couldn't find anything that worked for me. So in February of this year, I was actually in Chicago, and I went to visit with Gabe, and I went to see his new location. He had moved in the same complex, but he moved about a block away. When I went there, the space now that he has, his new space, is beautiful. It's about three or four times the size of the original space. And it's again, like I said, it's an industrial park, but the walls are exposed brick. Floors have been redone, beautiful wood floors, industrial look on top, track lighting, and he has, of course, his antique posters. He has antique display cases that are mahogany and glass. It's very, very cool. And when I walked into it, I says, oh, my God, this is a beautiful gallery. And, you know, gallery is actually a good location for what I do. So we started talking, and we came up with this idea to do my show there. I had been to Chicago. I've made four trips. I'll be honest with you. I've made about four trips looking for a space that would work for me, and I didn't find one that I liked that would make sense. And this one just felt right because it already has so much. You know the kind of stuff that he auctions off and the stuff that he has. It's just so beautiful. When you walk in, you get to see these beautiful. It's like Joe Berg's old magic shop, the photographs I've seen. With these glass mahogany cases all filled. Magic, you know, very nicely organized. It's just really a great, great space. And it's a beautiful gallery. I think, a marketplace where guys like myself and others who do what I do, it's a possible marketplace going into the gallery and bring people in to make them more aware that this place exists.
And the theater itself is going to seat how many? What, about 50 or fewer people?
Get it between 70 and 80 people, something like that.
Good. It's a good size group for the show.
Great size group, and it's an experiment because I've never done a gallery before, so I'm very excited about the prospect of.
It is exciting because certainly there are a lot. Perhaps I don't know if there are more galleries than theaters in New York City, but that could open up a whole new venue, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Without a doubt.
Interesting.
Paul Beale, he's working once a week. He's doing a full. So in a tattoo shop, I mean, it's a high-end place at the Maroc.
Right.
It's not a convention.
Right, yeah, I've seen the show, and I've been to King's Inc. there. Excellent show. And that wouldn't be some place that people would typically think, I'm going to the tattoo parlor to see a magic show. So it's unconventional, that's for sure. So the dates again, October 19th, 2021, here this year. And if people want more information, what is the website where they can go and get tickets and all that?
www.potterauctions.com. /events. You just go to the main auction, Potter Auctions, P-O-T-T-E-R. And Google it. It'll bring you right to the thing. And then there's an event page. You just click on that. And the dates and how you can order everything online is right there.
And we've also got an app even set up for that, so you can put it up kind of on your phone.
Yeah, that's cool. A friend of mine by the name of Scott Wells did that.
And you should be able to download that directly to your iPhone just going to app.cat/puremagic. That's app.cat/puremagic. And put it to your phone so that way that it has the phone number directly there to the Potter Auction House, as well as a map, and it can help you find your way there, and also a link to the website where you can order your tickets. And everything's pretty well complete, and information about the show, and also about Eric. And his past and his little biography on him as well.
It's such a cool thing. I've shared it with a bunch of my friends, and they're all looking it up.
I'm glad that to have the opportunity to chat with you. I hear about Pure Magic and the evolution of this one-man show, and I know that this is just, I wouldn't say the beginning. We're kind of in the middle of this journey.
Yeah, well, yeah. Life is a journey, and this is an interesting thing. And let's see what the next page brings.
That sounds great. So that's been Eric DeCantz, and let me ask you one last question then, because the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. What would be your magic word?
Pure.
Pure. Pure. That is a magic word. That's excellent. That was Eric DeCantz for Pure Magic. October the 19th through the 21st, they're in Chicago, and this is Scott Wells for The Magic Word. Scotty out.